Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there is always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm going to be your host for this episode. I actually just got back from a trip to Washington, D.C., where I was visiting one of my brothers. I visited him there, I think, 4 times over the past 10 years, and we always have fun exploring the art museums, seeing plays, going to the National Mall, etc. But this was going to be the last time because, for some perverse reason, he's moving to Utah Valley. I know, right? I tried to talk him out of it, but he just can't live without unfettered access to fry sauce. Anyway, when I arrived in D.C., we started to plan our itinerary, and at one point he giggled and told me that the sister missionaries had recently texted him, inviting him to the Washington, D.C. Temple open house. It was funny because my brother left the church a few years ago, and he was so not interested. I think I surprised him when I said, "Hey, yeah, we should totally go." After he spilled his ex-Mormon beer and choked on his ex-Mormon cigar in astonishment, I enumerated the reasons. 1. I had never been to the Washington, D.C. Temple, and this was my last chance to see its insides. 2. Wouldn't it be interesting, you know, in an anthropological sort of way, to tour it? 3. He did used to be a temple worker there, so he could point out all the changes the temple had gone through during its renovation. Wouldn't that be great? Somehow I convinced him, and we even managed to reserve 2 tickets for a Saturday. So after 1 day at the art museums and another at the National Mall, we headed toward the Washington, D.C. Temple open house. As we were driving, my brother pointed out the window and he quipped, "The church really hates that sign." And I looked and I saw a street sign with an arrow pointing to the left and the words Mormon Temple on it. I was actually a bad boy during the open house, by the way. At one point, I told a nearby temple worker that I was really excited to see what refreshments would be at the end of the tour. And when he told me that there wouldn't be any, I gasped. And I said, "What kind of Mormon event is this?" Immediately, a chandelier fell down, and Satan smiled in through the hole in the ceiling. I'll admit, the Washington Temple is quite an amazing structure. Yeah, actually, I noticed that the gold lettering on the side of the temple called it the Washington Temple, not the Washington, D.C. Temple. But you know, as a Mormon, if it's written in gold, it must be true. So I've heard it described as a cubist version of the Salt Lake Temple. And it's an apt description. It has 6 spires, 3 on each end, like the Salt Lake Temple. And it's very tall, like disconcertingly tall. Like you really have to crane your neck to see all the way up to the top tall. It is, in fact, the tallest temple. And it towers over the other temples by at least 100 feet in most cases. But instead of the ornate Gothic feel of the Salt Lake Temple, it's the closest the church has ever gotten to brutalist architecture. Seriously, take a look at a picture of it. It's made up entirely of straight, hard lines. Everything is a rectangle. Except the spires, which are long, thin, sharp, golden triangles. I'd say that it is by far the easiest temple to build in Minecraft. Now, part of the reason for its architectural uniqueness is that it's the last weird temple left from the 1970s. You remember, the church built 3 interesting temples that decade. The Ogden Temple, the Provo Temple, and the Washington, D.C. Temple. Yeah, the Sao Paulo, Brazil temple did go up in 1978, but it's pretty traditional. We all have our opinions about the original Ogden and Provo temples, often referred to as the motherships. But you have to admit, they did something that no other temples had done before or since, namely, be round. But, as we know, they are being renovated to look like the current temple type, square. interspersed with gentle curves. The Washington, D.C. Temple is the only one that made it through renovation with its exterior untouched. It's our last spaceship temple. From the front, the temple is entirely windowless. It's like a gigantic human-made cliff, you know, an impenetrable fortress. It's as if the temple is hermetically sealed off from the rest of the world. And as I looked up and up and up at this striking building, I felt something like holy terror. The straight, hard lines have no comfort in them, only power. It's an iron rod temple. Everything is straight and narrow. Anyway, while we were waiting in line outside the temple, there was quite a long line, a sister missionary offered to take our picture in front of the temple. And when I looked at the picture afterward, I noticed that she had framed it so that two of the temple spires seemed to be jutting out of my brother's head, you know, as if he were a devil. And I thought, perhaps the spirit of revelation had been upon her. Or maybe the Beelzebub t-shirt he was wearing had tipped her off. Though the outside was very interesting, the inside was even more so, especially the art, because in a place like this, art is used to tell the important stories, the ones that motivate the people who enter, you know, the mythology that's uppermost in their minds. So I paid close attention to what this temple considered to be the important stories. My biggest finding was that 90% of the art was from the four Gospels, and all of them involved Jesus. The interesting thing was that the variations on Jesus' face were quite significant, some of them going far afield from the Nordic features that we're used to in most LDS art about him. However, he was still always depicted as having fair skin. I saw only two images from the Old Testament, but one of them was Minerva Tykert's painting of Esther, and it wasn't labeled, so you'd have to actually know a little bit about LDS art history to know that it was from the Old Testament. Otherwise, you know, it could have been from the Bible or the Book of Mormon. And in the foyer, there was a bronze sculpture of Adam and Eve kneeling at a stone altar with Adam's arm raised to the square, which, as temple-goers would know, is part of the endowment session. Pretty interesting having that little spoiler in the foyer. There were two paintings that seemed to be from the Book of Mormon. One was in a stairwell where Jesus was posing with two children that seemed to be Native American. The other was of a woman who looked Latin, putting a soldier's helmet on the head of a young Latin-looking man, and I figured it was referring to the story of the stripling warriors. I saw only one picture from church history, and that was of the first vision, though it only showed Joseph Smith looking up while in prayer. No heavenly figures to be seen. There were also paintings portraying current-day situations. In the foyer, there was a painting of a black woman praying. Elsewhere, there was a painting of a black man dressed in white laying his hands on the head of a black boy who was also dressed in white. There was also a painting of a black woman holding a black girl on her lap, both of whom, again, were dressed in white. And I was actually pleasantly surprised at how much inclusion there was in the art. My brother told me that he remembered when the picture of the black woman praying was installed in the foyer, so it hasn't been too long. So, 90% of the art was from the four Gospels. Two images were from the Old Testament, two from the Book of Mormon, and one from church history. Admittedly, the tour didn't take us through the entire building. Perhaps they were hiding all of their Book of Mormon and church history stuff on the tech floor. Yes, the Washington, D.C. Temple has a tech floor. What this means is that the important story in the temple was definitely the four Gospels. And 90% of the artwork in the innermost sanctum of Mormonism could have been found in any Christian building. What did this lack of art unique to Mormonism mean? Well, it took a trip to the National Cathedral and lunch at Martin's Tavern for me to figure it out. So, after finishing up with the temple, my brother and I went to the National Cathedral. We thought it would be interesting to, you know, compare the two experiences. And, indeed, in so many ways, they were utterly different. Whereas the Washington Temple was made up entirely of straight, hard lines, the National Cathedral's exterior was as ornate as I have ever seen. It had so much detail that I was certain that most people who went there every Sunday had never noticed at least 50% of it. And whereas the Washington Temple is white, the National Cathedral is gray. And the polished, well-lighted aspects of the temple's interior contrasted with the shadowy dramatics of the cathedral. Now, I haven't had much experience with cathedrals, and according to the sign inside, the National Cathedral is the sixth largest in the world. So I'll admit that I was overwhelmed by it. There were so many stained glass windows, so many Gothic arches, so many sculptures, so many tapestries, so many stories. I felt like I was walking into a fractal. The deeper I got, the more detail sprouted. We were there for 2 hours, and I'm pretty sure we could have stayed the rest of the day and still not seen everything. Now, I spent a lot of time describing the temple's exterior and the art inside, so it might seem like I'm giving the National Cathedral short shrift by not spending as much time describing it. But like I said, there was just so much. I could process what I saw in the temple, but the National Cathedral far exceeded my bandwidth. So, after touring the cathedral, my brother and I went to a restaurant called Martin's Tavern, which prides itself on how many United States presidents have eaten there. We sat at the Harry Truman table. While we were eating, I asked my brother, if you were in a state of naivete, like if you came from another planet and you went on those two tours, which religion would you be more likely to join? He thought about it for a long time. And then he surprised the heck out of me by saying he would probably join the Mormon Church because, as I said earlier, he had left the church a few years ago and he wasn't making any bones about it. I mean, when we were touring the temple, he ran across a friend from his Mormon days and they were both very happy to see each other. But while they were catching each other up on their lives, he let her know that he had left the church right there inside the temple. And he had apparently posted a picture of himself smoking a cigar on the new BYUI alumni page for his graduating class. So when he said that he would likely join the Mormon Church based on those two tours, I asked, why? He had some good thoughts. The temple was, of course, surrounded by missionaries, all of whom were friendly, open, and sometimes even gushing with emotion. Based on them, he said, I would think it would be very easy to get into the church and into its social structure, and I would believe, from what I saw in the temple, that the path I would take in the church would be very clear and that I would be well supported. I wouldn't worry about being overwhelmed by anything because of all those clean, straight lines, that easy-to-digest imagery, and the friendly people. However, he said, if I were looking for something that had a lot of meat to it, something that could offer a lot of possibilities for exploration, lots of stories to plumb, and, you know, lots of symbolism to analyze, I'd probably go for the cathedral. All of the history and the stories represented there were really compelling, but I'd probably be worried about getting lost in all of it. There was just so much. I had to agree with him. And I would even say that the impression of Mormonism that the Temple Open House gave was truthful advertising. The church is easy to get into. It is full of friendly people. It supports you very well, as long as you're walking the path. If you stick with the Sunday experience and church materials, you'll never be overwhelmed, though scratch the surface, as many of us know, and you'll get all the overwhelm you can't handle. The temple used to be one of the weird things about Mormonism, but now it seems to be the totally digestible thing. Even the celestial room, which is supposed to be, you know, the most awe-inspiring part of the temple interior, kind of just looks like a living room from a middle-of-the-road American mansion. At no point did the inside of the temple overwhelm me. It was only the outside that did that. But still, in a digestible way, you know, I could easily identify each aspect, and I could easily build it with Legos. And it was then that I realized that everything in the Washington, D.C. temple was post-Mormon, which is a weird word to use. I mean, how could the Washington, D.C. temple be post-Mormon? Well, let me tell you about a presentation I attended at the Sunstone Symposium last year. It was by Jessica Garrett, who's an art historian. And she started off by saying that in the mid-1500s, the Catholic Church was going through something very similar to what the LDS Church is going through now. Namely, it was hemorrhaging members. Part of the reason was the Reformation movement that Martin Luther had started, and part of it was that through the invention of the printing press, the Bible had become more widely available, and therefore more widely interpretable. So the Catholic Church was looking for a way to retain members, and one of the strategies that they came up with was to invest in religious art. Now, we know the result of that investment. Masters like Caravaggio and Bernini created some of the most famous religious art in the Western world. And the church's strategy worked. The art ignited the religious imaginations of its members and kept them engaged with the church. Then she compared that strategy to what the Mormon Church did in May of 2020. You may remember that that was when the church issued some very detailed directives about which pieces of art could be hung in its church buildings. And you may remember that they allowed only 22 paintings. And most of them had already been in wide circulation for the past 30 to 40 years, and all of them have to do with Jesus. There were no paintings from church history and only one painting from the Book of Mormon, though its Book of Mormon-ness is pretty easy to miss. The only thing that really gives it away is the corner of a Central American-looking ziggurat in the background. The question she asked at the end of her presentation was, given their similar situations, why did the Catholic Church go in one direction and the Mormon Church go in exactly the opposite direction? One expanding and the other contracting its visual culture. I think I may have figured out why. It's likely that LDS church leaders used data to drive that decision. See, they know that more than half of the church's membership lives outside the United States now. They also know that membership outside the United States is growing faster than membership inside the United States. And they had to figure out how to build a story that would both motivate and unify all of them, no matter which culture they come from. The Catholic Church in the mid-1500s, meanwhile, was mainly interested in the area around the Mediterranean Sea, which was largely informed by the Bible. Now, if you grew up during the time period that I did, you'll remember President Benson giving his famous speech about how the Book of Mormon is the keystone of our religion and that we were under condemnation for not studying it enough. And the Book of Mormon, indeed, plays a huge part in what drove Mormonism's original growth. It named America as a promised land, which motivated a whole bunch of people to convert and immigrate here. And then, out of that mass migration to Utah, came the pioneer story, which was an essential part of American Mormonism when I was growing up. And it still is, I think. And for a long time, Mormons in Central America and South America and the South Pacific could tie their ancestry to the Book of Mormon people. But under scientific scrutiny, that connection is looking very tenuous. So much so that the church even changed the Book of Mormon's introduction to downplay it. And the Book of Mormon and pioneer stories just don't have much of a connection to people in, you know, Africa or Asia. They don't live in the Book of Mormon's promised land, and none of them have pioneer ancestors. So some other story needs to motivate them as well as connect them with the rest of the church. So church leaders decided that since Jesus is ostensibly the center of Mormonism, after all, the Book of Mormon is valuable because it's another testament of Jesus Christ, and Jesus had already gone out into the world over the past 2,000 years through the four Gospels, they would ride that tried and true train, sneaking in Jesus stuff from Mormon scripture now and then, you know, to supplement it. In other words, the church has become large, rich, and powerful enough that its leaders realized it can now get further by presenting itself as a flavor of Christianity than it can by emphasizing its uniqueness. And practically, I think they're right. For example, I'm interested in Buddhism, but I'm not very interested in its history. I've read the Tao Te Ching, the sayings of Chuang Tzu, I have a few books by Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, and, you know, a few by other Western authors. So you can tell that I'm mostly interested in how its practices and philosophies can benefit me. If they work, I use them. I imagine it's kind of the same for Mormons outside of America. The main things they're likely drawn toward is our friendly missionaries, our supportive, smoothly functioning communities, our prosperity gospel, and our overarching sense of meaning, all of which can be wrapped up in that phrase the general authorities just can't stop saying. Say it with me, folks. The covenant path. Most people are interested in the path itself, not its history. And you have to admit, Mormonism is really good at establishing functional communities. Being in a functional community makes it easier to establish a functional life, a functional family, and even a functional business. If you're living in a developing country, all of those things are really useful. And if church history and the Book of Mormon are helpful supplements along the way, rather than major hurdles at the beginning of your journey, you'll have a much easier time getting started. I saw this at play a few years ago when I was helping to design a book by a quasi-church group that teaches business courses to Mormons in some developing countries. The book showed how various people had become successful entrepreneurs by following some business principles. It was really interesting to see how the principles of business were presented a lot like the principles of the gospel, sometimes side by side. But you know, if you add business principles to a life lived in a Mormon community, you are indeed likely to get a good leg up in the world. But of course, let's also be realists here. This approach isn't just useful for church members in developing countries. It's also good for the church. If it's helping its members prosper in those countries, then those members are likely to become civic leaders, which will make it easier for the church to advance its interests there. And interestingly, it kind of looks like America is no longer a big part of the church's long game. America has, kind of been played out. We're so high maintenance. We're constantly demanding things. We like to split into political factions, and we're only one country. By focusing on the rest of the world, I guess I'd say LDS leaders are investing in the future. So, it's gonna sound weird, but I think all of this means that the LDS Church has gone post-Mormon. As far as its visual culture is concerned, it has decided that anything uniquely Mormon is heavier than it's worth. That our best return on investment is to present ourselves as a flavor of Christianity, which makes its relentless insistence on people using its full name and declaring the use of the term Mormon a victory for Satan totally understandable. Mormon is the name we have given to our unique scripture and history, and we've decided to let those sink into the background. It's a pretty interesting turn of events. About 40 years ago, Richard Craycroft, who was a professor of English at BYU and wrote articles on Mormon literature for The Ensign, wrote this, quote, "If we who are Mormon writers, critics, and publishers wish to speak to the saints, we must speak to them through LDS metaphors," unquote. And then, responding to his essay in 1995, almost 30 years ago, Michael Austin wrote, quote, "Embedded in the assertion that there is such a thing as Mormon literature is the claim that we as Mormons, and particularly as American Mormons, represent a cultural entity whose traditions, heritage, and experience deserve to be considered a vital part of the American mosaic. We are claiming not just that we are Mormons, but that we are Mormo-Americans, and that Mormo-American literature should be considered an important part of the American literary studies," unquote. I think those words may have hit their expiration date. According to the art inside the LDS Church's most sacred spaces, LDS metaphors are losing their official support, and Mormo-American literature is something that will have to make its own way through the world. LDS metaphors, as Craycroft was referring to them in The Ensign, are indeed Mormo-American metaphors, which have little resonance with what is now the larger part of the church. The Philippines is not interested in the Manti miracle pageant. I've been realizing that my particular Mormonism has felt very much to me like what scholar Jan Shipps described as an ethnic heritage. But my visit to the Washington, D.C. temple helped me realize that the church does not consider itself an ethnic heritage. And it doesn't for millions of reasons, all of whom live outside the United States and have completely different reasons for connecting with the church than I do. I'll have to admit that having this illusion torn away has kind of been difficult. I like the peculiar Mormo-American parts of the church. I grew up with them. I've even tried to add to them. I think the Book of Mormon is interesting. Church history is endlessly and sometimes terrifyingly fascinating. But the church doesn't see much use in sponsoring artistic representations of it anymore. That era is over. Mormonism is worldwide now. Being a member of the church means something different now. And there are some definite upsides to that. I saw people of various skin tones and ethnicities represented in the Washington, D.C. temple's art. They have become an explicit part of the church's inner sanctum now. And that wasn't true 50 years ago. Well, thanks for joining me for this week's episode. Just to remind you, Sunstone has a watch group on Facebook for Under the Banner of Heaven. Not only is our conversation about the show scintillating, we also have interviews with cast and crew, as well as with historians and other experts on the issues that the series covers. So go to Facebook and search for Sunstone Under the Banner of Heaven watch group, and come join us. Well, thanks again for joining me. I will talk to you again next time.